Wow. Emotional Mike, need emotional Rick. This is going to be, this is challenging as well. This is certainly an emotional time, an opportunity. You know, I knew I was going to be pretty good until he said he'd never heard me preach before. And I don't, is that a disclaimer? You know, hey, I didn't hear him before. You can't blame me. It's not like I knew this was coming. Hopefully not. But it did bring to mind, I think, a really tender and sweet time for me, an important moment for me. He said, if he hasn't heard me, I know I'd preached a couple times while he was there, while he was preaching at Hobart, but probably while he was on vacation, in which case the pulpit was then open for a matter of minutes, and somebody got a chance to step into it for that period of time. And the second time I stood up to preach, Garland Claxton's the name, so you guys can know who I'm talking about, I was nervous. First time, it wasn't quite as bad. I don't know why it was the second time that it really was getting the better of me. And Garland Claxton, he just says, I don't even know the words. I just know the sentiment. And the sentiment was, we're pulling for you. We're pulling for you. And it doesn't matter to you, for me, you know, you don't know me enough to be thinking about what's going on in my life and welfare, but I knew he did when he said that. And just to think, there's somebody on my side. When I'm standing up here, I got somebody on my side. I got Garland on my side. And I think I got pretty much most everybody else on my side. And I could pick out a few different people. And as a preacher, you learn what face to look at. Because there's a face out there that's going to frown the whole time. You can't look at that one if you're going to keep your confidence up. But there's one or two out there that's going to smile most of the time. And if you get a little difficult moment, you know, you gravitate back to that one. So I learned an awful lot during those years, and learned a lot just simply listening to, watching the many men who were there conduct themselves, and certainly Mike foremost among them. And he did say, I didn't bring a lesson, didn't bring my preaching paraphernalia, and so I'm going to take somebody else's sermon. It's an old one. It was preached a long, long time ago, and I'm going to start out using the old language version of it. And take one of Solomon's. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man of all his labor which he takes unto the sun? Now, you know, you ask yourself, I've already told you who I'm talking about. Sometimes I would read this and not tell you who's talking. So you know it's Solomon. You listen to this, you say, wonder why this guy is so depressed. What's got this guy so out of sorts that he just looks at his life, he looks at the world, he says, it's just meaningless. Everything's empty. I'm so depressed. What's going on in his life that he's just so depressed? Well, in chapter 2, he kind of sums it up a little bit. We'll fill in the blanks as we go along. But in chapter 2 and verse 9, he says, I was great. I increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem, and also my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor. Isn't that normally the formula for depression that you think of? That a person gets a chance to do everything he ever wanted to do, didn't withhold any pleasure from himself. I just enjoyed every moment of my life and did whatever I wanted to do, and I am so miserable and so depressed, and life is empty, and I just can't stand it anymore. It sounds a little off, doesn't it? And yet, that's where he was going. You read through chapter 1, and he thinks about the tedium of life, the water cycle, and and the fact that the wind is blowing this way and blows that way and then comes back this way, and nothing really has a purpose. And he was a man that had lost his purpose in life. That doesn't mean he didn't try to find it. He didn't look for it in different places. If we go to chapter 2, we can kind of chronicles his journey on trying to find what's going to get him going and get him excited in life. He said, I said in my heart, chapter 2 and verse 1, go now, I'll prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. So we're going to look at some of the things that he's doing, and we can translate them pretty readily into 21st century life. But he says, laughter, mirth, verse 2, all these things, I was going to have a good time. And when you throw in verse 3, he said, I sought it in my heart to get myself to wine. How many people do you know, do you work with, are out there, who this is how they're going to enjoy their lives? They're going to have a good time and they're going to drink. What do they call it? They party. You know, you got your nightclubs, you got all this stuff going on. People go out and they party. And this is how they enjoy their lives, how they fill their lives. And gives them their purpose and satisfaction. Well, Solomon had tested that. And it really, well, we're going to find, well, we saw already the conclusion that he drew. We go on, he says, he was equating his heart with his wisdom. I've always wondered about that. He says that through this period a little bit. I don't know how those are compatible, really. I kind of struggle with that. But he says, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. It's almost like this was a kind of a case study that he was engaged in. Let's live this way for a while and see how that turns out. Maybe so. He says, I made me great works, I built in me houses, I planted me vineyards. Yes, this is the King James, sorry. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth the trees. So what else did he do? He says, I just dove into work. I did all kinds of different works, engaged in them, built some things, accomplished some stuff, got a chance to stand back and look and see all the stuff I had made or I had commissioned to be made, however the best way to say that. So that was how he was going to satisfy his life. In verse 7, I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of provinces. So what else did he do? I got stuff. Men servants and maid servants and livestock and silver and gold. You know, he famously said that silver and gold had gotten to me like it was just bricks. You know, the way you and I would look at a paving stone or a cinder block. Gold brick looked like that to him. He was just so surrounded by opulence that wasn't all that special any longer. So he moves on. He says, I got me men singers and women singers and delights of the sons of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So entertainment. Tried different ways to entertain myself. See, you look down at the list, and his list is not that uncommon to a list that people would make today, is it? I went out drinking and partying. I dove into work and just buried myself and immersed myself in work. I got stuff, all kinds of stuff. What's the mantra? The man who dies with the most toys wins, right? I got me all kinds of stuff, and he was going to win that one. And then, well, any type of entertainment. I sought it out. And so now he's kind of look back over his life. And as you've done Ecclesiastes, I'm sure many times yourself, this isn't any new stuff to you. Did you ever wonder why he left one thing out? That he famously liked women. Lots and lots of women. 700 wives, 300 concubines. Does the phrase obsessive, the word obsessive compulsive, something like that, jump into your mind? Some guy who just thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to get me some women and I'm going to get happy. How long did it take before he was going to realize that wasn't going to happen? I'm just trying to picture. Here it is. He said 700 wives, right? I mean, when you're getting ready to get married for the 652nd time, are you thinking, this is the one? This is the one that's going to stick. I'm really going to enjoy this one. And then, of course, there's Mrs. 652. Wondering what she's getting into. Well, knowing what she's getting into. And I think I'm in the minority on this. I wouldn't want to try to poll anyone. I know other preachers have said you're wrong. But I've looked at the Song of Solomon as basically answering this. As basically looking at, okay, he got himself a nice, attractive little shepherd girl, that little dark-haired girl, dark girl that he's taken and ruined her life completely, taken her away from her love, and been sold to the king, and he's going to marry her, and so he's all excited, and he describes her, but you want to look at that description real closely, and there's not one mention of her moral qualities, of the spiritual qualities of the woman. He describes her, and then they get married. And a couple chapters later, he's describing what I'm going to call this porcelain-skinned Nordic goddess that he's now enamored with. And again, no spiritual qualities are enumerated in that instance. Whether that's the microcosm of his relationships, that's a correct view of it, you can decide. But clearly it represents, I think it's a good illustration of what it would be like for the obsession that he had. Clearly he was trying to fill his life with something that wasn't filling his life. So, he says, whatever my eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the portion of my labor, and I looked on all the works that my hands had brought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. That's how he got to me. That was the conclusion that he drew. Now, I want to jump down to chapter 3. It talks about a song famously written at the beginning of that chapter. Time for this and a time for that. And he says in verse 11, that God has made everything beautiful in his time. Good song.
Good song.
In his time. God has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I'm assuming pretty much nobody else has a King James, and you wonder, that's not the word I've got. That's good. He said eternity. He has set eternity in their hearts. And I'm going to talk for a little bit about that idea, about that thought, what it means to have eternity set in our hearts. It's a word, you know, you think about eternity, we think about the endless, vast expanse of space, we think about the vast expanse of time, time immemorial, space immemorial, power, limitless, eternity. When you think of those things, hopefully what comes to mind are the various attributes of God. And then indeed, as we have been made, and I'm going to suggest this very much to you, that God has placed that kernel of his nature and of a connection with him in our hearts. But the way it's stated, one of the definitions there, when you look up that word that's translated eternity in most of the versions, different words, but one of them was void. And I looked at that and I thought, wow. Scientists talk about the fact that, you know, the universe is expanding, and it's expanding into a vast expanse of nothingness, into a void, emptiness. And so now you think God has set this emptiness, this void in our hearts. And another way of saying that he has kind of put a hole in our hearts, an empty space. And it's an empty space that I believe is designed to connect us to Jehovah God the Father. And I believe man inherently has that in his nature. You know, the atheists have looked out and looked at the various cultures of man and said, oh, look at all that they worship, all the different ways, the empty, idle, mindless superstitions. Everybody seems to want to worship someone or something. And there's a lot that's incorrect, clearly, about a lot of that worship. But you know what I think it does speak to is the fact that God has put within man's heart that need to connect with the divine somehow, some way. Now, it's key that we have the revelation that helps us to connect that. Yes, the heavens declare the glory of God and firmament displayeth his handiwork. That helps us to realize there is a God. And then there is this empty space within us that helps us realize that we need that God and we need to connect with that God. But then, of course, we need that revelation to help us to understand how and the terms of that relationship. He has set this empty spot, this hole in our hearts that he alone is designed to fill. Maybe I can put it this way. What's a 220 outlet? You don't stick a 110 in there, right? You got to have that special plug. You got to have the one that fits. Or maybe in more modern terms, a USB, right? You got to have the right one. And it's the only one that plugs in there. And we've got that receptacle. We've got that hole. We've got that spot in our hearts that is designed for God and God alone to plug into. He alone is the one who will fill that hole in our hearts. And so what do we find around us? Look around, people, at those that you know, you work with, your family members, your neighbors, who are trying to fill that hole in their hearts with some of the things that Solomon was using to fill that hole. With alcohol, with entertainment, with promiscuity, with work. And they keep trying to fill that hole and they're not succeeding. You know, to me, one of the sweetest and most powerful illustrations of this came a little over a decade ago. We were watching our grandbaby. The kids, my son and daughter-in-law, had gone to FC for lectures, and this was their first time to leave that little girl with Nana and Papa. And she was a good trooper. She did really well, but she, you know, she's missing her mommy. Yeah, she missed her dad. But she was missing her mommy, you know, really missing her mommy. And it was getting probably last day, second to last day, she enjoyed her crackers. And so she said, "Cracker, Papa, cracker." Okay, we didn't like to just throw food at them just because they, okay. So give her a couple crackers. And it was, "Cracker! I gave you crackers. Cracker, Papa." You know, so this goes on. A couple more crackers. And "Cracker, cracker, cracker." I'm dumping crackers on the table. I don't know what's going to do. And it took a while before this brain. She's trying to fill this hole in her heart. There's this mommy-shaped hole in her heart that she's trying to fill with crackers. And it finally got through to me. She's missing her mommy. She needs to connect with her mommy. Well, another day came along and she got a chance to fill that up. But the crackers were never going to do it, were they? She couldn't identify what it was she was missing. But so it is. Most of the people around us are in that same dilemma. They don't know what they're missing. They don't know what their purpose is. They don't know why they have this little hole in their heart. Some have done a pretty good job of callousing it over, right? We know those. But others are still trying to find what plugs in there, how to fill it. And so they bury themselves in work. Or so they get stuff and more stuff and more stuff. And it just isn't working. It just isn't filling them up. You know, we're told, Colossians, that Jesus is the fullness of him that filleth all in all. That's who Jesus is. And we certainly need him in our lives, and we need that connection. If we were to continue on in Ecclesiastes, go to chapter 12. You know, he makes a statement in verse 1. "Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. You know, his point starts out, remember God in the days of your youth. Remember your Creator. And, of course, a lot of people, most that we know, are always looking for the angle, right? Wouldn't it be better to just kind of put that off for a while? You know, have your good time early in life. Do what Solomon did. Enjoy yourself. And then later in life, turn to God. But, of course, what Solomon was realizing as he was in it was that it wasn't worth doing. But that the point that's made here towards the end of his sermon was that remember God early, and then remember God all the way through. Because there's going to come a time when he continues on in chapter 12, when you just get too old and wore out and rickety. You can't hear, you can't see, your legs don't work, your back doesn't work, everything shakes. You jump at every little thing, even though you can't hear it, you don't know what's going on. It's just, you're all spent. And now, to have satisfaction in life is much more challenging, much more difficult. To have satisfaction in that relationship with God, you know, that's not a burden, that relationship that we should have with God from our youth, but a great blessing that he gives to us, that we can have that relationship all that time and be benefited by our connection, that connection to him. I don't know what happened to Solomon about losing that connection, at least for a while. Clearly, he did. And clearly, he and his dynasty was punished for that loss of connection. I pray, I hope, I wish that as we look at the end of that particular book, that he came to his senses at the end, kind of like Manasseh did. You know, in the last two verses of chapter 12, he says, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." You may just have a translation that says, "For this is the whole of man." This is all we are about. What is our purpose? You know, that's always a great question. I do a funeral. That's certainly one of the questions I ask and then answer two ways. Why are we here? Man, we're here to eulogize an individual. More importantly, why are we here on planet Earth? And he says, fear God, keep his commandments. This is what we are all about. The God is essentially recruiting volunteers to be a part of his citizenry, to be a part of his kingdom forevermore. And this is all we are about. This is why we're here and what we want to prepare for as we leave here, to be good, true, honest, loyal citizens of God. And as we stand before him as volunteers in his kingdom, Jesus embraces and owns us and says, just as he did in John 17 with the apostles, he says, these are mine. I kept them for you. And I'm giving them to you. Don't you want him to say that for you? This one's mine. And here he is, Father. What a sweet thing, what a precious thing, what a wondrous thing that will be. Because when we stand there in that moment, we're going to realize there was nothing else in our existence that mattered than that. And oh, the agony for those who don't get that endorsement from Jesus in that moment when he delivers up the kingdom to the Father. We're not in it. We're not a part of it. We had better stuff to do. We were trying to fill our lives up with things, and it was going to hopefully last us for eternity. We don't want the other guys to be excited. Talking to Mike a little bit ago about one of my favorites out of Isaiah chapter 14. King of Babylon, talking about the king of Babylon. And the earth, they were excited. The earth itself, the planet, was just singing for joy when the king of Babylon died. And hell was excited. He's coming here. We're anxious to meet him. You know, there's going to be one or two celebrations at the end of our life, isn't there? There's going to be the angels of heaven just enjoying it and embracing us. And they're going to be the devils of hell saying, all right, he's here. Which celebration, which party do you want to be a part of this day? And offer that invitation to you right now. What do you want to be a part of? You want to be a part of that group of people that God is going to embrace, that Jesus is going to give to him and will take with him for all eternity. Does that sound like what you want? Or have you got other things that are better stuff going on? And you're okay meeting the guys down there on the other end. Because maybe that won't be so bad after all. Maybe the rich man really wasn't suffering. Maybe Jesus didn't really say that you're going to wind up essentially in that garbage dump, the Vale of Hinnom, maggot infested, constantly burning. Maybe that won't be so bad. We got to decide. We make the choice. He's calling us and he's asking, come and be a part of my family. Come and be a part of my kingdom. What does God want from us? He wants children. We all know what that's about. He wants children. And he wants you to be one of them. If you're not a child of God, I encourage you to become one right now. Or if as a child of God you realize you've estranged yourself from him and the prodigal son tells us we can come back. Do you need that opportunity? Do you need to avail yourself of that opportunity today? If there's anything we can do to help you with your obedience to God and your preparation for the world to come, let us know how we can do that as we stand and sing.